Actually, it was, I've had it zip tied to a 2x4. There was no metal involved, so I really don't know how it was that low, but, I'm just glad it worked.
Dick, could I please get in after Ben? My battery is extremely low.
Okay, I heard a station on the input. It's not coming through the repeater, so maybe you don't have your PL turned on. Go ahead with your brief statement, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. I don't want to take it away from Ben, so I want to know if you could tell me, how do I load, test, I don't want to replace him unless necessary. Ed, WB2EAV, certified just... certified, keep on using it and charge it, it'll come back. It seems to me. What do you think, Dick? And then I'll just listen.
Rich, during that last transmission, every 5 seconds, you dropped out for 5 seconds, and then we came, then you came back, then you dropped out for 5 seconds, and then you came back. I can tell you're asking some kind of a question that's got something to do with a road test. That's all we got. N2EO, wait for the beeps. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Boy, why back on channel?
AC2GS here.
Yeah, Roy, I think you're hearing the problem that Rich is having. Do you have a suggestion? AC2GS, K2LIW.
I just wanted to mention that he popped off of EchoLink, but then he popped back on. So hopefully if we give a pause, he'll come back and he'll try and give us his question again.
Okay, we'll stand by for Rich. N2EO, we're going to stand by for you for a full 30 seconds. So, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, if you hear me now, I want to know if it's necessary and possible to load, LOAD, load test the battery to my wheelchair. Ed, WB2EAV, said if I keep using the chair and charge it up on a regular basis, the batteries may come back. They seem to be coming back. Other than load testing in this, what Ed suggested, is there any way I can rejuvenate the battery? Back to Ned.
Yeah, I'm going to make a guess that your batteries on your wheelchair are made for deep discharge type? And can they recover after going through a number of charge-discharge cycles? I think it's possible, and we did have a discussion a couple of months ago about a kind of a circuit called a battery rejuvenator. So does anybody have any comments on whether or not probably deep discharge lead acid batteries on his wheelchair, which he was deeply discharging them, and he did notice a definite decrease in ampere hours. But after a number of cycles of properly charging them, is it possible they can come back to life? Anybody have any further comments on that? Please give me a call. That is right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
AC2GS?
You got it, Roy.
Well, you were talking about sulfonation of lead acid batteries. What happens is there's lead in one electrode, there's lead oxide in the other electrode, and there's sulfuric acid. And when you do deep discharges or really misbehave with the battery, you get these lead sulfide compounds, crystals that grow that make the electrode kind of irreversible and problematic. And that's what all these little gizmos promise to do, is they tend to suggest they can shake off the sulfide crystals, and some of them do it to a degree or not. His battery might improve a little bit, but I don't think it'll ever be anything close to the way it was when it was relatively new.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. If a lead acid battery, even the so-called marine type or deep discharge type, would be that easily recovered just by going through a number of charge-discharge cycles. If that was true, there'd be a whole lot of people telling us that story. I think the chances of you coming back to full life, Rich, is kind of slim. Whereas you did make the mistake of deeply discharging those and not following the manufacturer's recommendation of recharging your chair each individual night. Where you bypass that recommendation, I think there's a moderately good chance that you've done permanent damage to those batteries. And if you want the full ampere hour capacity to be restored, I think there's a high probability you don't have very much choice but to replace those batteries. And the new batteries, do treat them with tender, loving care. Follow the manufacturer's recommendation. N2EO. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Fortunately, N2EO, he just popped back on Echolink, so I'll let a pause for him. KD2CTY.
I heard KD2CQI, KD2H, UC, I think it was. Stand by for another minute for Rich, if he can come back on, and then I'm going to take those two people in that order. N2EO, we're waiting for you, K2RIW.
Okay, Jeff. Don't thank you very much. You know, the batteries are not that expensive. A pair of them is $100 in Target, other places. But I have a new girlfriend and I want to take her out. I'd rather spend $100 this month with her at a fish place, fish restaurant. So that's why I don't want to buy them till December or January yet.
Yeah, I hear you. But from all we know, Rich, where you did allow those batteries to be deeply discharged, which is something you're never supposed to do with lead-acid batteries. You're never supposed to go beyond the 50% point of discharge. Because when you do, you're doing damage. And the manufacturer told you to recharge them each individual night, which we didn't think was required, and I think it was. So I think the chances of bringing those batteries all the way back to full life is very slim. It's worth a try, but I don't think it's I don't think they're going to come all the way back. KD2CQI, start off with your name, sir. K2IW in the second hand. Go right ahead.
KD2CQI, name is Ed.
Go right ahead, Ed.
I have a battery charger. It's a company called Clore, C-L-O-R-E. And they make battery chargers for like 12-volt batteries and 6-volt batteries. And their literature claims that they recondition the battery before it charges. It actually analyzes the battery and reconditions it as it charges. And I've had some luck with some 12-volt automotive batteries. They seem to charge up when they're completely dead. So it does work for a while, but eventually the battery is dead.
So that Clore, C-L-O-R-E device, I think you're saying it gave you some improvement as a rejuvenator, but never really brought the battery all the way back to life, and it didn't last very long. I think that's what you're saying, Ed. Is that true?
I got an extra year or two out of the battery. It did work for a while, but then eventually that doesn't work either.
Okay, during that year or two, were you getting full ampere hours out of the battery, or just something partial that you could tolerate? Please wait for the beep when I give it back. K2LIW.
It was a fully functioning battery. It did charge completely.
Okay, I'm not sure you answered the question. Please wait for 4 beeps before you transmit when I send it back to you. Statement number one. Statement number two. I think you're telling me you had a battery that was acting defective, nowhere near the right number of ampere hours. You use this Clore rejuvenating device. From your point of view, what percentage of rejuvenation did it give you? Yes, you got an extra year or two out of it, but was it a marginal performance during that year or two? Did it come all the way back to the full ampere hours, even for that year or two? I think the answer is no. Please wait for the beep. You've got it, sir. Ed, K2LIW.
The answer is yes. It did work well for that year or two.
Okay, the next person was KD2HUC. Start off with your name and your comment. K2RIW in the second half. Steve, that's an excellent suggestion. Rich, you can go to a well-equipped garage where they do have a load tester for lead-acid batteries that are in automobiles. They have a full-power load tester. You go to the right garage, they'll probably charge you nothing for that test. Let's see if Rich heard that. That's an excellent suggestion, Steve. N2EO, did you hear those words? K2LIW in the tech net.
Did he fell off Echo Link once again?
Sure wish he had an RF link to where he can. I hope he's. Yeah. I can tell by the way I was hearing Echo in the background. I think by way of RF he can hear the repeater. Just can't transmit back to it without Echo Link. Hopefully he got that message. What's your guess on that one, Raj? Here we go. AC2GS, K2IW, you got it, boys.
Well, he might have a receiver, but that might be his sole connection. I don't know of any way to really test that other than ask him if he pops up again. I get the sense he's using his cell phone, and I get the sense that his cell phone battery was low, and that might be why he's dropping the connection and coming back and dropping the connection. So, I don't know. I wouldn't be terribly optimistic, but worst comes to worst, he can listen to the archive with the answer.
If he knows the information that there is an answer we have for him, that would cause him to go through the archives. Okay. Paul, WS2N, I think you had a question. You got it, Paul. K2LIW and TechNet.
This is WS2N. Yeah, I had a question about EMR radio. I've heard a lot of people talk about it, but just curious. From what I understand, you could transmit, let's say you had a radio. I'm looking at one particular one. It's a Lenko DJMD40T. It's, you know, 70 centimeter radio, so you can, you know, work repeaters. But it also has DMR. But from what I understand, you could transmit and somehow get the signal into the Wi-Fi system, and then you can talk, you know, once you're out on the Wi-Fi, you can talk to other people with CMR connections. I'm wondering how you go about doing that. You know, I don't see any kind of receiver that comes with this. I would imagine you need something to hook up to your router, you know, to do that. Just, you know, wondering how you do it. I understand some people use their cell phones. I just don't quite get it. Back to this.
Okay, it is my guess, Paul, that a DMR radio is a very specific RF device which is able to transmit in a packet-like manner. It's flipping back and forth every 20 milliseconds between transmit and receive. It's running full duplex, so to speak. Flipping back and forth between transmit and receive. It's a Motorola creation, I think. And so it's a very specific RF radio that does that. Let me pass it over to Roy, who probably has AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy. Yes, Eric, you've got a lot of DMR experience. KE2EJ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Eric.
Hello. Okay. DMR that you're talking about is something called a DV dongle. Essentially, it is a little radio receiver and transmitter. And what it does is one side hooks up to the internet either via Wi-Fi or direct connection. And the other side is intended to use with whatever particular radio type codec that you were working with. The reason for that is that the audio compression of DMR and a few other things is proprietary, so they cannot actually take it from an audio level and do the encoding. So essentially what it does is it takes the data that's coming out of the radio and sends that into the internet to the appropriate mode. And the reverse happens is the data from the internet and transmits to the radio, and the radio does its encoding. Are you with me so far?
Yes, I think we're with you so far. You're about 50%. We're hearing all your words, but they're quite noisy. Go ahead, Eric, K2EJ, K2IW. You haven't dropped out, but you are 40% noise. K2IW, you listening?
I don't see 375 for whatever reason. I wonder if it's even running. The point is that DMR specifically is one type of transmission. It's called C4FM. You can think of it as QPSK. You can think of it as four different tones on a carrier that's used to transmit the data. A bit more complex than that, but that's sort of the basic idea. Fusion uses the same transmission format. P25 uses the same RF format. The differences are in the organization of the data and how the audio is compressed and turned into data. Those are the differences. The DV dongle is really agnostic to the format in terms of how the data is packaged and transmitted, whereas
the radio that you're using at your end with the Zini dongle. So the idea is that you could be walking around your house using your HT and getting into the DMR system, even though there may not be a DMR repeater around. Same thing for Fusion, same thing for the C25. What else? Oh, the one that I'm really missing is D-Star. It's also available for D-Star. So basically the device takes the IP information and retransmits it on the appropriate frequency and with the appropriate modulation scheme. Modulation scheme for DMR, Fusion, D-Star, and P25. The RF part of them are all the same. What they call C4FM. C4RWKJ.
With a question.
HUC, please stand by for a minute. I suspect that you got quite a bit more information than you requested a Paul. And so, Paul, let's see if you've got further questions. And I'm putting myself in your shoes, and I think hearing all this for the first time is quite a bit to swallow. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I've been reading QSC last month at page 56. They had an good article, but nothing's pointing to like the dongle that Eric is speaking about. And I don't see that these radios come with this dongle. I mean, where do I get this thing? I mean, that's part of the confusion. Something must have to plug into the router. You know, the RJ45 port. Something's got to plug into that, and I would imagine that would be the dongle thing. That's part that's confusing. In other words, I see the radio. You know, it's a beautiful looking Olinko radio. It looks like an HD, but it's not. It's a DMR. Well, actually, it is. It's 70 centimeter. But got to be a way to transmit. I mean, if I'm just going to transmit 5 watts on this thing, there's no repeaters I'm going to be able to hit with this. Not from my location. I don't have an outdoor antenna. But if I can get into the Wi-Fi system, that sounds good. I just don't know. I don't see this gadget, this dongle thing that we need to do that. Thank you, Dick.
H1, are you a comment?
KE2EJ, K2RIW. You think you can clear this one up, Eric? Go ahead.
All right. The device I'm talking about, if you do a Google search for DV dongle, okay, DV, digital voice, for example, a couple of people. I'm not aware of anyone putting that device within the radio itself, meaning that it will take the transmission or the IP data and transmit that directly into Wi-Fi. The device that I'm talking about, the DV dongle, has a Wi-Fi device in it, and as long as you have a router that's Wi-Fi and it goes to the internet, you have it set up to go to a particular network, like it could be for D-Star, it could be for DMR, it could be for Fusion. It will pick up your receiver, your HT locally, pick that up, and turn it into Wi-Fi, which then goes to whatever service that you're dealing with. So you can have a DMR radio, any DMR radio. And with this device, even though you may not have a DMR repeater around for 100 miles, you would then still be able to get into the DMR network by utilizing the Wi-Fi, making a connection into that network. Does that help at all?
Did you ask with a question for Paul?
Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Paul. Do you really mean Wi-Fi, or could you possibly mean Bluetooth? Because there are radios with Bluetooth-enabled interfaces that you could use with cell phones and computers and such, which is a little bit different than everyone's talking about right now.
Do you want to use a comment?
I don't think it would be the Bluetooth, Roy. I heard somebody else put a comment. Dick, over to you.
Yeah, we've got both Steve and Ben in that order. Steve, KD2H, UC, I think you wanted to make a comment. And then we'll go over to Ben after that. You got it, Steve.
Yeah, Dick, I have a question for Eric. When they do the IP conversion from the regular, what would be RF data frame to an IP frame, is it strict encapsulation, or do they have to manipulate the data before they actually adapt it, so to speak, into the IP frame? Okay, to it. Back to net.
You got it. Wait to Steve. You got it, Eric.
There's a story. Actually, what the DV dongle does is de-encapsulation, and it encapsulates the IP data. And essentially what you're doing when you're using a GMR or a D-Star or any type of digital radio is you're really transmitting packets just like your cell phone does. Your cell phone does it by a couple different methods, either CDMA or CDMA, time division multiplex. The DMR is essentially time division multiplex. That's why the packets in the RF blast are 20 milliseconds wide with 2 milliseconds in holes in between them. So in essence what you're doing is your radio is really an audio device that's turning the audio into a bunch of packets. Those packets are then put into an IP stream, just a traditional TCP IP stream, which is actually modified with headers to identify the type of information in it. And that goes through the internet to get server, to the next computer, so on and so forth. Does that help?
WS2N, K2IW, you got a poll.
Okay, to answer Floyd's question, I don't think it's either Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. In other words, you plug this to someone. From what Eric says, you plug this dongle into I would plug it into my Wi-Fi box because they have different ports on the back. I would plug that in there. And this thing would transmit to that DV digital voice dongle. Now finally, I know what Eric was saying. He was a little noisy in the beginning. I thought he was saying TV dongle. I didn't know that the TV dongle that they used to buy. So that confused me. So now we know what we're talking about. I'd have to buy a digital voice dongle, plug that in, and then this radio would be transmitting to that device. That's what it sounds like. And this is starting to sound like something like a Magic Jack telephone system, you know, where you plug something into your Wi-Fi box. So hook up your telephone to that. That might be a digital voice dongle as well. Okay, well, I got this from the Weimark news website, so, you know, they have the news on that, so that's where this all came from, DMR, Alinco Radio. Looks good. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Eric might have some further words on this. KE2EJ, wait for the beeps. You got it, Eric. K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2J, can you copy me?
Right now, you are 85% quietly. Go ahead.
I'm in the part of the sound. We're very mobile. I dial up the UHF machine. I'm using that for the moment. You want to repeat the question because I couldn't hear it?
Paul, please repeat your question.
I'm wondering if I have this right. You know, from what you said, you're calling it a digital voice dongle, DV. I thought you were saying TV, so that was the confusion there. Like television. You're a little bit noisy when you were originally saying that, but now I know what you're saying. But that sounds like this gadget that you would plug into the same port on a router. If you were using something called a Magic Jack, they have different things now. We operate your telephone system through that. It's starting to sound like that device is a digital voice dongle.
basically all it sounds like all I would have to do is send away, get one of those, plug it into the port on the router, and then it sounds like I would be in business if I had this radio. But what do you think, Eric?
Okay, cool. If you've got something called a DV dongle, and you know, once I'm in front of my computer, I can give you the more specifics as to who make them, what they cost, and that kind of stuff. Essentially, either through Wi-Fi or a direct connection into a router port would get you into the internet. Like if you're doing, say, DMR, you're going to have to open up port 5000. That's typically what they use. Make sure that passes through your firewall, and you use your radio. The dongle picks up what your radio is doing, sends it into the internet, gets you into the network. And whatever's coming back from the network goes through the dongle, gets transmitted on UHF for your radio to receive. That's the whole thing.
You've got a poke.
Very good. Offhand, do you know what frequency you're going out on when you're transmitting on DMR? I'm assuming it's 70 centimeters, is that correct?
Can you tell me what's coming?
Yeah, they make them 70 centimeters. It can also be 2 meters also. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure the ones that I've seen so far have all been UHF, but I heard of a VHF one being made. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's a few VHF DMR repeaters in our neighborhood too.
KD2 in November, Oscar Uniform. Coretta has been. KGYW.
Whether those dongles have software for whatever digital mode that you're interested in. Something like DV dongle only works with DSTAR. There is something called DV4 mobile, that works for all the major digital. There's something called Shark RF that works for all the digital. And you can either get the type that plug in and require you to have some digital handy talkie that transpose the codec into the computer, or you can choose a slightly more expensive dongle that includes the codec, the voice compressing algorithms, and then it's just a matter of playing computer with it. You don't even need a handy talkie under those circumstances.
KD2HUC, K2RAW. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, Eric, you said before that the EMR is transmitted via frame. So that presents the issue of possible latency if packets take different paths. Is that handled strictly at the IP level, or does the EMR frame have an index or some other method of being able to identify the correct order to reassemble the packet? KD2HUC, back to next.
KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Alright, KE2RIW, K2J. Again, I'm having a little difficulty hearing. I'm trying to listen on echo link even, but the cell site isn't strong enough yet. We're getting close to one on that. In essence, what the CMI does is it's got a format which has to assemble the packet. There's also a certain amount of forward error correction. There's also a little Richard Solomon, so they don't do an out of order type of package instruction. It is within order. So the error correction, it usually doesn't miss until you hit the RF brick wall. The things just begin to drop out, and then I don't know if you listen to DMR, but when somebody hits that threshold, it sounds kind of weird. And that's because it's trying as hard as it can to make up the packets that are missing, but there's got to be enough forward error data to be able to do that. When the signal gets so weak, you can't. So, RIW, KJ.
Okay,
it
was Paul who asked the original question. Let's see if he's satisfied. WS2N. K2RIW, be good, Paul.
Okay, now I got some information. I'll be able to get a good idea what to look for, what I need, what I don't need from the information that I got. Although, you know what, Dick, CW is still easier. But you got to stay current here. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yes, we do. And staying current with all the things that are changing, sometimes it's quite difficult. I'm going over to a particular email here. And, okay, I didn't find the right email yet. We're going to go over to now the science physics section and or mailbag. Roy is now up. The maven for science, physics, and mailbag. So, and I think you've got some, depending on whether or not you've got enough mailbag responses that are worth going to, Roy, or I know you've got a couple of specific physics and or science questions or announcements. You've got it, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
May I ask my question?
Who are you?
WHYY asked to be put at the end of the list about 35 minutes ago.
Okay, we tried going to you and you couldn't take us. All right, now we can. Go ahead, Joe.
Very good. Simple broadcast question. How long is the antenna situation at Empire going to exist where it produces a weak signal on some digital channel because of the multiple antennas being used for transmitting? I'm just kind of curious on that. 1 year, 2 year, 3 year?
I think that's a question for Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I'm sorry, Dick. What was your question?
Repeat your question, Joe.
Oh. I was kind of curious on how long the antenna situation is going to exist from the current transmitting site, which I believe is Empire, that uses multiple antennas on some certain RF frequencies, like 28, 33, and 38, which produces crappy reception out here, when, and especially when there's a band opening. Those are the first channels that take a hit and go off the air. How long are those antennas going to be in that configuration? 1 year, 2 year, 3 year?
Okay, by December 13 will be on Empire. NBC is in the process of moving there. CBS is in the process of building their stuff. Actually, NBC is actually there, but they're not going to. They're not actually going to change the situation until they shut their current channel off because they're just banned with NJU. So, you figure between the end of this year and the end of the following year, everybody that's going to move, because not everybody's going to move, everybody will have moved, and that the cockamamie antenna system on Empire will get changed.
You've got it, Joe.
I missed some of that because your RF quality into the system is not very good right now.
When you were on 450 before, Eric, you were dead full quieting. Too bad the 450 is not working now. KE2EJ, K2IW.
And also Paxton is up there now, too. So you've got 2 years to look at that will give you a reference. And then come December, you'll have count 15.
Go ahead, Joe.
I still miss the key word that he said. Is it going to be a half a year, 1 year, 1.5 years? I missed. He said something about some channel, but I didn't hear you say that they're being relocated to someplace else. I'm not sure. I must have missed something because of the RF quality.
Okay. You can figure by the end of 19, a lot of things will have changed. People who are going to move to World Trade will have moved. People who are going to stay at Empire will stay at Empire. Sometime between 19 and 20, the antenna system that gives you those problems will get changed. Actually, what I remember they're going to do is actually move to the other antenna, which works a little bit better, that belongs to someone else. And it seems like a couple of the stations may change their mind about moving to World Trade. So, you figure by 2020, things should be pretty squared away.
Okay, so that's like 2.5 years. That's a long time to wait. That's too bad.
There's an old expression that I used to hear, live hard until you get water. It looks like you've got to wait most of 2 and a fraction years for all the improvements to take place, Joe. W-H-L-Y-Y, K-G-R-I-W.
Well, you know, it's only going to affect one or two stations. Everybody that moves to World Trade is going to have a dynamite signal.
It affects two, Dick. I heard you complain about the same RF channels and not being able to get them all the time. So, you know, if I have to suffer, so do you.
Yeah, right now, the band openings we're having today from Philadelphia, among other places, are knocking out a number of my channels. I wonder if you're experiencing any of that, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm getting code channel from 33 up in Hartford. That kills CBS. RF-28 gets hammered by the Maryland Public Broadcasting when they come up here, and there's something in the same vicinity on RF-38 that kills Channel 9, and it kills us quite a length of time during the day. Channels like Channel 5, 36, 30, the lower Channel 7, 11, so forth, they don't seem to get bothered, so, you know. It's just too bad that certain broadcasters on certain RF frequencies decide to do certain things a certain way.
Yeah, Joe and I are some of the very few people watching over-the-air television on Long Island these days. Almost everybody is on cable, satellite, something else. And so because of band conditions today, I have very little reception of channels 2, 4, 9-3, 9-4, and 25, and 33. I normally get those 95% of the time. Today, I'm not getting those because of a co-channel interference problem. If I had a rotator on my television aerial, I could solve an awful lot of that. But at the time I wanted to buy a rotator, they were out of them at the store I was at. So that's one of the conditions I've got to correct. Anybody with further questions or comments on this particular subject, give me a call. Letters right now. K2IW, the tech man.
K2IW, K2IW. Can we go back to my question when I had the wood 2x4 mast on ground plane for the mobile antenna?
Yeah, I've got a guess as to what probably happened, Ben. And that is, because you measured such an extremely low standing wave ratio, your system thought, your antenna thought it had a ground plane. The way it could think it had a ground plane, even though there was nothing there but a 2x4, is that the length of your transmission line just happened to be a even number of quarter wavelengths, a number of half wavelengths, all the way back to the shack. The grounding of your rig, the transmitter, in the shack, was your counterpoise, and your transmission line had to be some exact number of half wavelengths. You hit it lucky. That's the good news. That's how your standing wave ratio, that's the only way I can think of your standing wave ratio on a 2x4 would be low when the shield goes nowhere. However, when the ground is being supplied all the way back in the shack, that means you've got RF in the shack on all of that transmission line on the outside of it. So that fits all the conditions that you described. Low standing wave ratio, RF in the shack, but yet the antenna was happy. Once you put the ground plane radios on it, you stop the problem right at the end of the transmission line. You see what's going on there, Ben? KD2NOU, K2LIW in the tech net.
Hey, roger that. That was probably what was happening. Yeah, it must be lucky.
You are lucky to have the right length of cable. But when you're using the whole cable as a grounding system like that for multiple wavelengths, the cable is going to be hot. And so you're radiating from both the radiator of the antenna as well as the shield of the cable. And with the RF in the shack, I think some of your equipment in the shack was starting to behave kind of funny. Is that true, Ben?
It definitely was.
Okay. Sounds like you've got a beautiful solution. And sounds like you're in like Flynn. Is that true?
Was the end of that? I missed it.
You have no problems at this time. Is that true, Ben?
Not that I know of.
Other than you'd like to have a great big pile of money from ham radio. There are guys that used to make a joke about making money with their ham radio while driving to work in the morning. Of course it was phony. Okay, we're going to go over to Roy. He's going to give us, I think he's going to mention the word, and I'm going to plug in a couple of words here and Roy's going to correct me. The very first reception they got at the LIGO, Laser Interferometry Gravity Observatory. Let me drop. The very first response they got out of that system, something like a year and a half ago, was two black holes coming together. Each one of them was around 30 solar masses in that vicinity, and a pair of them came together. And when they came together, because each was a black hole, even though a tremendous amount of forces and energy was being transferred inside of a black hole, none of it could get out, and therefore you didn't see anything. The most recent event was a pair of neutron stars. Neutron stars are much lower, quite a bit lower in mass than a black hole, and when two neutron stars come together, you get a blast of energy that's probably equivalent to a majority of stars in a galaxy all going supernova simultaneously. tremendous blast of energy, which they now call a kilonova. Is that approximately what happened in that most recent event, Roy? AC2GS with the science section, T2IW and TechNet.
AC2GS, yes, that's exactly what happened. The LIGO, you have to be careful. It's the Gravity Wave Observatory. It doesn't really detect gravity. It detects gravity waves, which are slightly different. They've had four different occurrences of finding two black holes circling and collapsing in on each other in the past. And aside from the fact that black holes really don't let you see much of anything, they also were pretty far away. But on August 17th, all of a sudden, the LIGO Observatory is kind of lit up in a very strange way. Because all of a sudden, there was this very long-duration signal that isn't like black holes. So they immediately thought, aha, we have neutron stars here. And they picked it up on LIGO. They didn't quite pick it up on Virgo, which is an Italian gravity wave detector. And they picked it up on a gamma emission detector. And then it was a free-for-all to try and figure out where it was in space. And it was in the southern area of Hydra, constellation Hydra. It was in a in an oblong galaxy out there at 130 million light years. And it put on a great light show from RF all the way to gamma rays.
The previous events of a black hole coming together gives you a chirp that lasts a small fraction of 1 second. These two neutron stars coming together gave you a chirp that lasted for something like 30 seconds. Is that true, Roy? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it lasted some ridiculous amount, like 100 seconds. And the only reason why the signal finally kind of got cut off was the frequency it was emitting was higher than the device's ability to register. So if you ever see the illustrations, the curve goes up, 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 and then disappears. And then 1 second later, the gamma detector detects an outpour of gamma ray emission. So that was probably just when it really hit the metal, if you will.
I'm going to guess that each of these neutron stars were in the vicinity of three solar masses, in that vicinity. Can you imagine something three times as heavy as the sun? A pair of them, these are very compact devices, something like the size of Manhattan, and these two extremely heavy, massive devices are circling around each other at something like thousands of times per second. Is that how the frequency went that high? Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2IW. That's an awful lot of very high energy physics.
Yes, it's a lot of, it's high for a matter of a bunch of reasons. The two neutron stars, one was is believed to be something like 1.1 sun masses and the other 1.6 sun masses. But, you know, they might change that as they look over the numbers. But that's still hefty. It's all down to about the size of roughly 10 miles long, each of them. So basically a teaspoon of this stuff weighs about 100 million tons. So that's heavy stuff. It's basically neutron stars are the core of larger stars than ours. Collapse beyond the point of protons existing. The protons capture the electrons, and everything's just a cloud, a bush together neutron, and it's just kind of like one big, enormous atom filled with neutrons and little else. It's an incredible thing. And you bash two of those damn things together at a fast speed, and you get a lot of interesting stuff that glows in the dark, which is what we were watching. Gold and platinum and all kinds of radioactive material that decays almost instantaneously.
Now, is there a estimation of how much energy got dissipated in that event at the end? I presume it's way beyond the energy of a standard 1A supernova. I presume we're getting close now to the energy that would occur if a tremendous number of the stars of a galaxy all went supernova. supernova simultaneously? Have they mentioned how many joules of energy got dissipated at the end of this event? Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
Don't believe so. I haven't read anything where that comes up. They're really fascinated by the amount of gold that was produced, anywhere from about 5 Earth masses to 100 Earth masses. More of platinum was produced than gold, apparently, and it spewed out about 16,000 Earth masses of just stuff that it created. And it's believed that that's where heavy metals, heavy elements, are primarily made. Originally, it was thought to be in supernovas, but it's not a very efficient process in supernovas. So they had to find a different mechanism for most of it to be created, and it seems to be a neutron star collisions, and also it showed the gamma ray burst, which was a theoretical possibility, but it pretty much proved out. So a lot of the theories were proved in August.
Now, the end of this event was called a killer nova. Does that mean it's because it's a very large number of times the energy of a so-called supernova? Is that why it's called a killer nova? Over to you, Roy.
I don't think so. I think it was just some guy's cute idea of how to say nova with an exclamation point, and super was already taken, and so I don't think there's anything that really scales up to a 1,000 that they gave the kilo to, although I might have missed it entirely. I haven't read anything. It sounds like the same way that people came up with the name quarks for quarks. It's kind of capricious, I think.
Okay, I think we've got to do a little bit more reading on this one, Roy. It is my guess that we're going to find out that the amount of energy dissipated during this event was a significant number of times greater than an ordinary supernova. That's my guess, but we'll soon find out. Now, when it comes to neutron stars coming together, is the prediction that those kind of events are more prevalent than black holes coming together? I mean, so far we've had so few events, you can't make a judgment as to which one's going to dominate. But the astrophysicists, who know a little bit more about the probabilities of what's going on in the galaxy, and even between the galaxies, has anyone predicted that there'll be more of these neutron star events than black hole events, or vice versa? AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And WS2N.
Paul?
Oh, I was going to let you answer first. I was just making other comments, so you want to answer Dick's question first?
Fine. I don't think they have hard and fast numbers. Neutron stars are very common. They are the product of exploding stars that are approximately 10 to 20 sun masses in size. And that's not an uncommon type of sun. So the universe is probably littered with neutron stars. And a lot of stars are binary stars. So it's probably not terribly uncommon for binary neutron stars to rotate around each other. And eventually, as the orbit deteriorates, it gets close enough to produce gravitational waves, which sap a lot of the momentum and cause them to fall into each other.
It's kind of hard to believe that of all the stars that are out there, more of them are binaries than unaries. Our sun is a unary, but there are more binaries than stars sitting all by themselves. Trinaries, I think, are a little bit more rare. So, because there were so many binaries, such a high percentage of the 100 billion stars in a galaxy are binary stars, sounds to me like the capability is there for a whole lot of these events to eventually be detected by LIGO. Paul, WS2N, KQRIW, you got a call.
It's good that this topic is making the news. It was quite impressive to see it on different news stations. So that's good. We covered a little bit on the astronomy net that Craig had last Tuesday. And then I saw...